Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is June 20th, 2022, and my guest is Nassim Nicholas Taleb. This is Nassim's 10th appearance on Econ Talk. He was last here in July of 2020 talking about the pandemic. Nassim, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Thank you for inviting me again, and thanks for allowing me to test my ideas on you before completing my books. And also have to admit that a lot of my economic education comes from Econ Talk, the reasoning, the economic education, the economic reasoning, because you read stuff in books, you learn it at school, it doesn't work. In a podcast form, because you have conversation between two people, somehow it helps ideas sink in and stay there.
Well, I said it's a huge sacrifice to have you on again. Like a few other guests, you're one of my most popular guests.
Yes.
You're also a guest that occasionally, there might be two or three people who ask me, why do I have you on? But
it's okay.
I buck the trend. Fine, you know. I'm a contrarian, and you're back.
I guess if it's only two or three people, I may be doing things wrong. You need to have more enemies.
One needs to have more enemies.
Yeah, okay.
I'm very polite. It might be 30. Might be 20 or 30. Our topic for today is a big picture topic. We're going to talk about the nation, the state, and some of the principles of governance. We're going to draw on a few recent pieces of yours on these topics that we'll link to. I want to start with the difference between a state as a nation, which you talk about in the ethnic sense, a nation, and the state as an administrative entity. What's the difference? Why is that an important distinction?
For the notion of nation state is extremely modern. And I think it's not till 1780 that people started talking about it. And of course, you had what we call nations now as territories of kings. So, and then the king would acquire the territory and would expand whatever the kingdom would be. So then, of course, people became addicted to the notion of nation state. And then we had the German-Italian unification and other things. But in the past, and of course, the French, what I call domestic colonization, when they just realized that they were a state, and about 50, 60 years into their idea that now we're a state, they decided to destroy anything that was not French in France, and French as defined by the upper-class language that was spoken in the area near Paris. So, and then Jules Ferry banned all local languages. You know, you go to school, you get punished for speaking Patois, Provençal, the dialect of Strasbourg, the Germanic dialects, Breton or other, you know, they call them dialects, of course, because a dialect is basically, a dialect is something that doesn't have a nation state. A language has a nation state. Anyway.
So this concept, which is a fairly modern concept, a couple of hundred years old, or maybe even less, this was the nation as a homogeneous ethnicity, speaking
not necessarily
a common language.
Homogeneous. Like for the French, their idea of the nation was those who would want to acquire French because it was the formal language. So not necessarily ethnic. And then again, the notion of ethnicity is very weird because, you know, you have recombination, recreation of ethnicities every day. Just like you have languages are born every day. They separate. So you have ethnicities developing all the time. And the Turks, for example, when we talk about ethnicity, what is an ethnicity? Is it a race? The Turks created their nation state, and that's when they decided to lose whatever tolerance they had for the other. And, you know, Turkey, what's Turkey today was, when it was the Ottoman Empire, had a huge number of ethnicities. or people speaking different languages, Armenian, Greek, Kurdish, and then in the south, Turkish speaking, but Alevis, people, Christians who spoke Greek, and then different varieties, Greek, Maltese, Greek. They had all these, this mosaic of people, and people who spoke the Levantine dialect in some parts of Turkey. You had all of these. And then they became a nation state, and sure enough, they tried to destroy all these minorities. I mean, visibly, we know about the Armenian and Assyrian massacre. They also had people who spoke Aramaic there. And so they had the massacres, and it became intolerant, because a nation state, by definition, is something intolerant. And of course, there's one interesting thing about it is that it's not really ethnic, because when you think about it, when you do the DNA of Turkey today, you realize that it's maybe about 7% Turkic at the most. The entire Western Turkey is Greek. They're Greeks who convert to Islam, and with Islam came the Turkish language.
So what is the sense in which a nation in the ethnic sense is a meaningful example?
When it's very small, okay, when it's very small. And if you're going to have a nation state, it must be the smallest possible unit. Because if you make it too big, then you start having minority problems, you start having conflicts. And let me explain it, okay, in this term. Why scale is important, when two people are roommates, they can have fights. They may not get along. But then you instead of giving them, say, 1,000 square feet for two people together at school, or you break it to 500 square feet for each, and each one has an apartment, they'll get along a lot better. And there have been studies showing that good fences make good neighbors. And we saw that in Yugoslavia. I mean, we saw that in Switzerland historically, these cantons, which effectively are sort of states, small states under some kind of umbrella. But if you look at what happened in Yugoslavia, look, they're getting along now. How many states they have? Croatia, Montenegro, Slovenia, the North Macedonia, all these states, okay, they get along because each one has a little home. So even if they're open to commerce with others, see, it's still better than what it was before.
Now, there's two aspects of scale here. One is that in certain dimensions, and you can expand on this, obviously, in certain dimensions, small works well generally. There's some economies of scale also, but small works well. But it's not just that it's small. You're making the claim that when I clump my smallness with people like me, my ethnic group, my so-called nationality, we can solve our problems in certain dimensions more easily than if I'm trying to negotiate across roommates. That's the point you're making, right?
Take a very simple example, Copts in Egypt, okay? The Copts are being persecuted in Egypt. But if they had their own state within Egypt, if they were not geographically distributed, but they were concentrated in a small state, it would be a lot better for them. And it's the same thing with a lot of countries. So that idea of the state is modern. Okay, the state as a person, an entity, that kind of Hegelian, idea of reification states. It's almost like a person and a new person. Okay, composed of others, that fueled a lot of Germanic ideas. Of course, we know. That idea is very modern. In the past, you had ethnicities, you had different groups, but the administration was a city. And the city is a place that obeys laws, okay, some laws, and pretty much it was an administrative entity. You had a city, and city-state flourished, whereas nation-states historically, and I discussed that in Anti-Fragile, turned out to be fragile. Empires fared well. What's an empire? The difference between an empire and a nation is that an empire has absolutely no interest in your life other than collecting taxes and making sure you don't wage wars. You don't ally with their enemies or wage wars. So basically, it's a tax. It's a mafia scheme. It's some kind of piso, as the Italian would call it. So that's pretty much what an empire was, and the emperor. I mean, the empire is last long when they don't overcharge the people there, so they're happy. And I know the from history of the Phoenicians, they never really had a big nation. They were small city states, and I said, okay, so what? The Persians are going to come, 10%, okay. You know, cheaper than having an army. And who's going to come after? Oh, you're going to have Alexander's come, 10%, cheaper than having an army. And then the Romans are going to come, 10%, okay.
So when you say 10%, you mean or tribute to the
tribute
team.
to whatever yeah. you're going to pay them. So taxes. It's cheaper taxes. Yeah, it is. And after the Bronze Age collapse, you know, where all these big states, Hattusa, vanished, the big important states, Egypt, you know, was brought to its knees. The city states of the Eastern Mediterranean flourished. So,
but in modern times,
yes,
city states are rare, and if anything, the impulse is to expand. So the classic example would be the Sudetenland, right? So there's a piece of Czechoslovakia that happens to have a lot of Germans. So Hitler says, I think that should belong to Germany because those people want to be part of Germany. Now, of course, some of them did, some of them didn't. Their neighbors, like the cops you're talking about, they were not all in one little place. They were spread out among other ethnicities and other peoples. And nation states tend, in my historical observation, my observation of history, to expand to try to grab more of the local ethnic group rather than to be more pure and homogeneous. So what's going on there?
That's true. It depends if you're rural or if you're not urban but based on are you deriving your livelihood from land or from commerce? So the Phoenicians were not interested in land; they were interested in commerce. Same with Venice. Take Singapore today. You see, they're not interested in conquering land. They're not interested in geopolitics. They're interested in making money. See, so they become that. There's that tolerance of city states that you don't observe. Incidentally, one observation: you are located in a nation state now, currently as we're talking. Okay, a few time zones away.
I am.
Yes,
I am.
Yes, and what's the name in the language? Their language. What's the name of that state?
I'm in Israel.
Yeah, no.
Which
what's
is,
the name? What's the name?
The city is Jerusalem. That
no,
I'm
no,
in.
No. The name of the state on your passport. What does it say?
Israel.
No, it says Medina. It says
Medinat Israel.
Israel. Okay. So from the
country word comes, of Israel.
No, no. Is it Medinat means it actually in Arabic the same word Medina means city. So it means deen. Deen is law. It means I live under the laws of Israel, and that's a city state. City state is a body of laws. If you look at it,
it's
laws.
Like
I live under the laws of that place.
And
a state is a body of laws, basically that you're accepting.
And in a or not, but that's you're under their rubric. The modern nation state, which of course is. There are many different ones of different sizes. They have varying abilities to enforce their laws up to their borders, meaning
yes.
In the United States, if you live in South Dakota or California or Texas at the edges of the country, the federal law pretty much still applies. You can hide in a cabin somewhere off the grid, maybe for a while, but in general, you're going to be subject to the administrative entity known as the United States. But there are other nations where that's not so true, right? You live in the borders of that geographical country, but the administrative entity does not fully extend all the way to the border reliably. Is that's correct? No.
I can you give an example? Where
Somalia, China,
on paper, yeah, of
even
course,
China,
of course,
even China,
course.
Right? Which is people think of as authoritarian state. I mean,
that's I was actually what you're saying traditionally held, okay? Because today the modern state has tools. They represent a lot more of the GDP than it did before. In France, up to I don't know how you count education, 50-70% of GDP comes from the state, whereas 100 years ago it was. One almost an order of magnitude lower. So the state was not very powerful in the past. And if you take the French language distribution in France, for example, it was along the tax routes. So that because the king can tax these areas, so the it was very limited, the access of the state. They didn't have radars, they didn't have satellites, they didn't have all these tools of enforcement. They couldn't spy on you. They didn't have the internet. So we had, the state is had different morphology. But let me make a comment here: why size is central to what we're discussing, because people keep using names, state, nations, and stuff. The size is central. You do a lot better, I think, meeting a person 1,000 times than meeting 1,000 persons once. So in other words, you're in a big city like New York City, you walk out, you're going to see every day different people. But it's going to, okay, so whereas in a village, you're going to probably encounter the same number of people, assuming you encounter, it would be the same people. So it's like knowing it's a friend, is a person that you see 1,000 times. You see, one person 1,000 times rather than 1,000 strangers once, you see. So the things don't scale properly. There are things that work differently at a lower scale. And that's what I've discovered while working on volatility models, to show that why an elephant, for example, is not a large mouse. An elephant is vastly more fragile.
Explain.
Okay. Because of the way the risk scale, an elephant falling by 1 meter would break a leg and would never recover. A mouse, visibly, is vastly more robust. Okay, so we can see some biomechanical things, and it comes from the nonlinearity of shocks. And to use an example, I have an antifragile, the story of the rabbi who one day was asked by the king to find a solution to the following problem. He had to punish his son who committed a certain crime, and the punishment was to crush him with a large stone. So the rabbi said, yeah, of course there's a solution. He said, what? He said, you break the stone in pebbles. So that nonlinearity, falling 10 meters once is vastly worse than falling 10 times 1 meter. So most of my work since like 2009 has been on this, finding the effect of these nonlinearities in places, and hence a large state is actually more fragile. It requires an increased expenditure in monitoring. So when we take Russia, for example, that has always been a large state. It has to curate an identity, centralized. It has always been centralized, always has a curated identity. And throughout the three regimes, had the same system. You see, that big sprawling country, and of course it has to be aggressive because that's the mode on which Russia was built.
The three regimes, you meaning the Tsarist regime, the Communist regime, and whatever you want to call
now,
the current
what
regime?
We have now, yes, they had the Cheka, KGB, FSV. They had almost the same apparatchiks, kept moving. What happened is you kill, hang, or fire the top people in administration. But as we know from Trump's experience, he went to Washington. He had to face an infrastructure that was entirely hostile because they were all Democrats. And didn't like him, and you can do so little. You see, in an administration, when you change the regime, the same thing happened in Iran. They kept the same apparatus that the Shah had, to monitor dissidents. They used it, and of course the in local offices have got to be the practically the same people. It takes a long time to change the administration, but when it's large, it is a severe problem.
So let's go a little deeper into this.
Yes.
Let me start by, I love, it's a very provocative idea that if I see 1,000 people once, it's very different than seeing one person 1,000 times. It's a very interesting way to think about quality versus quantity in terms of how you interact with your children. It's a very deep idea. I don't see how it works in this case, though. So let's start by going deeper into that. And for example, New York City would seem to me to make a pretty good city-state, but are you saying it's already too big? It is operating like a city-state.
Yeah,
it has to be Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, and even then I'm still not going to see somebody often. Okay. It's not a village.
No, we have to understand that the U.S. is not a republic. The U.S. is a federation where you have a lot of power to the local municipalities and local cities, and New York City is effectively a state. You can view it as a state, and the way it does business, the area, the New York area, is pretty effectively a state. They say that the optimal size of these units is about 8 million. See, so the notion of city-state is, let's not go by labels, let's go by the function. If you look at functional, so like the area around London, the area around Amsterdam, and then the word tend to cluster now in these, to these kind of zones. But the nefarious aspect of the state that I was discussing is when you have a top-down state and it needs to curate its identity all the time, it becomes like Russia, very aggressive. It cannot tolerate neighbors who don't abide by their rule. It's imperial in nature. And then, of course, you have the story of Ukraine. Now, to go back to the notion of empire versus nation, okay? We are going to, the beauty of an empire, and the Ottoman Empire lasted long, the Roman Empire lasted very long, the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian lasted long. They were always multi-ethnic and mostly, distributed states, and they were there for their tax, and of course to make sure that militarily the area is theirs. But not the police. I mean, you can, have a local police. What is important in that thing is that we recreated that model using NATO. You see, when you can have now, instead of having an empire protecting you, you can have a some kind of self-protection mechanism via some kind of league, okay?
Well, it's a way of overcoming the economies of scale problem. If you're small...
You stay small, exactly. So what happens is that when you have economies of scale, that notion for when I keep arguing that you can't, it's not, it depends on a domain. It is domain dependent. You need to be centralized for military, although in some cases it helps to have decentralized military, as Al-Qaeda and U.S. right, replicate their model with the building of its unit. But And size, what is large, okay, for example, a restaurant with 100 tables is large, but a company that manufactures, chemicals, needs to be 100 times the size to be large, or 1,000 times the size. So it depends on the domain. And it looks like the thing that requires centralization is a military. And of course, and I will argue also pandemics. And I've argued that people like von Mises and Hayek said the state is needed for centralized activities such as epidemics and wars. That's Hayek. And von Mises accepted the state. They didn't hate the state. They just said, their idea of the state having its function. And that function is things that cannot be done by other units. And that's the notion of subsidiarity, under which the European Union was built. Unfortunately, execution is not in line with the claims, the initial claims. We got to back up.
The whole point that I understand you to be making, both in the pieces that you've written recently and going back to your books, Skin in the Game and Anti-Fragile, the value of the small scale is to maintain skin in the game. It's to maintain...
It's also, you have skin in the game, exactly. Because a local ruler, okay, a bureaucrat in Brussels is not going to be punished if the bridge doesn't work well. But the local mayor, particularly if it's elected among the citizens, will, have, to encounter, at a cafe on Sunday afternoon, would feel shame if she or he, fail in the project. So there is some kind of skin in the game, and particularly when you elect people embedded from the community.
But that's a very lovely idea, but it doesn't I don't know how you get there from here. So let me take,
you have to look at where it worked and how it worked. It worked very well in Sweden and the Scandinavian countries that are already small, and they got smaller. You know, Swedish and Norway speak languages that are close together. Okay, but when you talk about other countries like in the Middle East, countries that speak languages, they call it Arabic, but they're absolutely not connected. Okay, I mean the dialects are not mutually understandable, but so they broke up things as fast as they could, and within the way they manage their provinces. Okay, it is bottom up. Switzerland is the country that is built to be bottom-up and to stay bottom-up, where you pay most of your taxes to the municipality and the residual to the canton and to the local unit and the residual to the state. Whereas things that were came, you know, from the old world were top-down. By the way, Germany has always been bottom-up. You know, there were 300 states before, the French Revolution, 39 states when it came to unification. And of course, now they have their Bunds. So now because after the people didn't realize that after the war, the French wanted to punish them. They said, unification, then you get Bismarck, and then you get Hitler. You know what? Let's make sure that they're a federation so they unify. And that's what made them strong economically. So they wanted to punish Germany by making it a federation.
Distributing the power.
Exactly. Yeah. Distributing the power allows for things to work better.
Why?
Well, as you mentioned, skin in the game, there are also a lot of mechanical things, and you also have to understand that the bureaucrat thinks in terms of geopolitics and abstract matters, whereas the local person thinks in terms of water, bridges, cleanliness of the
schools,
stuff like that. Yes.
Yeah. So, as an economist, the way I think about it, which is similar but not exactly the same as the way you think about it, I think about it as that, you know, I want to be in a club. Ideally, I want to be in a club with people who share my preferences. We can then do things together effectively, but that's going to be a very small club. So it has to be bigger than that, usually, and I'm going to sacrifice some autonomy, some freedom of choice, and in particular, there are going to be situations where it's inherently going to be a conflict that we don't agree, say, on the size of the military, size of the police force, and we accept that restraint on our ideal because we understand that the gains from banding together are sufficiently large. When you go past that point, and I'll use the United States as an example, all of a sudden there's a potential for cross-subsidization. And the political process can start to devote itself to rent-seeking, to exploiting certain groups at the expense of others. And you're stuck. You can leave. To leave the country is relatively costly. And the politicians are then able to pass certain regulations and laws that are not, quote, for the good of the people, but are rather good for certain people, not for others. So what you're suggesting, and I think it's maybe you don't agree, but what I think you're suggesting is something that was unimaginable 25 years ago, but I think is increasingly likely, which is that the United States will divide into more than one country. California could be its own country.
For that. The United States is designed to be divided into one country. All you have to do is weaken the federal government's role in some affairs. And increase the role of the state. The problem is every time I talk to people about it, the Republicans love the idea of a strong state, okay, weak central government. On the other hand, they want a strong state over the municipalities, as we saw with COVID. So we already have the structure in the United States for what you're discussing. You have states. Okay, you get the idea. Right. The idea exactly. Just have states.
I think it's called the United States.
Exactly.
It's hard to remember that name actually isn't just like Fred. It's an actual description.
Exactly. So people may be fighting in Washington over something and in the states over something else. What matters for you is what happens in your municipality and in your state, not in, far away. And states here are uneven. Have size problem. Some states are very small. Some states are very large, like California, so Texas. So effectively, all you have to do is redistribute decision-making from the central government to the states.
But that's not very popular. Although, again, I think the South could secede, again, ironically. The coasts could secede from the Federation, right? You could have California, Oregon, Washington state called a new country. You could have the East Coast be another country, the Midwest would be a country, and the South would be a country. Now, what would be wrong with that? There would be two things potentially wrong. One is they'd still need some, perhaps, unified defense policy, although it's not obviously so necessary because they have the oceans. But the other idea that's fascinating, which we haven't talked about, is that people like the idea of belonging to the United States of America. They used to. I don't think they like it so much. I don't think there's a national narrative that's shared by those four countries.
The notion of national narrative, again, I mean, in my work now, the notion narrative should not be the driver, because national narratives change all the time. This is why when you're small, it's easier. Again, it's a matter of scaling. They can change narratives much faster. And I saw the piece I wanted to discuss today is the one I wrote on Ukraine versus Russia, not because we care about Ukraine. We care about Ukraine, of course, we care about Russia, but because it represents a model and it's a thing. It's a talk I gave in Ukraine during the summer. I was a guest of the government and I saw what was happening and where I explained first that you can speak Russian. It's not a problem. You don't have to create a new category, linguistic category. You can speak Russian and not be part of Russia. The Russians couldn't get it, but the Swiss get it. You can speak French and be culturally linked to France, but administratively linked to Switzerland, where it works better. So first I started explaining that you had to break up that notion of state equal nation equal people. That equality, and that effectively you start having pathologies with the nation state, where the whole nation, as an entity, on balance acts against the interests of the individuals. See, where you have these things that start emerging from bad scaling. So, in that piece, I said what we have here. It's a war, and then I rewrote it, after the war started. I said, we have a war, not between two countries, not between East and West, between a model, the new model, which is NATO-based, where basically all we have is you could have any kind of NATO, so long as our defense is ensured as it was during the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, under Alexander, under some kind of new imperial power, which is NATO. Shared decision making.
You see, a confederation of military power.
Exactly. For and then you do whatever you want outside of that. You see, and what we call the West is not the West versus Russia. It is the West includes Taiwan. You see, so look at and when you look at that model, all right, it is a classic liberal model. And when you let nations start working at nations, they focus on prestige. Like Napoleon was interested in prestige of France. The English couldn't understand him, and he didn't understand the English. The English were interested in commerce, and couldn't understand why this person hurting his economic interests in the name of prestige, simply to prevent ships from carrying merchandise across his territory. So he couldn't understand the English. They couldn't understand. They were already one century apart, you see. We're living in Adam Smith's world, where the pencil is made by people who have never met one another and don't even know, that their contribution is going towards a pencil, except for one. We're living in that world, thanks to some globalization. And, of course, it can have its its limits. So what people are, nobody really wants autarky. So what we're disagreeing about is the degree of the limits of that globalization. Well, how you know, but nobody wants to go back to autarky. So when people say I'm against globalization, they usually mean I would like it reduced in some places to exactly to be managed better. But globalization visibly is the name of the game today. And that idea of people obsessed with national identity and prestige and stuff like that is very archaic. But it was already archaic 225 years ago.
But don't you think it appeals to people? I mean, isn't part of what we talked about Brexit with Meghan McArdle based on Roger Scruton's book, Where We Are? Don't people have a sense of self, part of their identity that comes from where they live and the pride they have in their country?
And it changes all the time. That's the problem.
Why is that important? Explain.
Okay. This is why I like the minimum deliverable. See, the minimum deliverable unit in size, because when things are small, they can change more easily than when things are big. It's, again, a matter of scaling. You see, running Russia, which is, say, is much more difficult, much more than 10 times more difficult than running a country a tenth of the size. Gets disproportionate. You have to curate an identity. You have to keep creating an identity. The state has to keep managing things. The flag, the anthems, the history, the language, and all these matters. And it gets harder disproportionately as the state gets bigger. It's just like the stone harms you more and more as it gets bigger, disproportionately. So you double the stone, you have four times the harm. Yes.
So in the United States, you're suggesting that at its current size, given its diversity, it cannot curate an anthem, a narrative, a language.
It can, because the United States is probably an exception to that rule because of the way it's built. In the United States, you realize the federal government doesn't enter your life that much. You know, the municipality, the county, the state, the smaller units enter disproportionately. And a country like Russia under Putin, as it was under, you know, the czars, Putin now names the governors of provinces. And you end up having a large state with at least 100 ethnicities, Russia, that needs to be curated all the time. Because otherwise it would break apart.
So I want to get this. You gave me half the story of this recent essay. Ukraine is Western, you're arguing. It is de facto, kind of, under the umbrella of a military confederation known as NATO. France is part of that. Germany is part of it.
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is not there yet. That's what it wants to be.
It's longing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's aspiring to be part of this, what you call more bottom-up, quote, Western approach.
Exactly. As
you point out, Western is a misnomer in the sense that Taiwan is in the West.
Yes.
It wants to be a independent entity. What's the other side? What's against the West?
The other side is a Tsarist model, okay, of centralized, over-centralized administration curating an identity and a large territory and needing to acquire more territory, because you have to think of the genesis of that. Okay, think when we had Venice. Venice was a flourishing republic for 1,100 years, more, 1,100 some years. Venice, it did not try to acquire territory. That's not the business they were in, you see. It tried to acquire places like Famagusta and other spots for commerce, but not like for the sake of territory. That was not their business, you see. Russia's business is to acquire territory. Plus, we have to think of Russia.
Why? But why? Why can't it just be content
started.
Having its big
You know, that's
big
how
self.
It started. When you talk about ethnic state and you have said ethnicity as of when, you see, when people go back in history and say, oh, this is a territory, every piece of the world that had belonged to some other group, so claiming historic ancestry. But Russia is very weird because it's the one, it has two exceptions. One is the a place that was formed by migrations coming from west to east, you know, from the Volga, the freshwater Vikings coming down and mixing with these populations west to east. And the other one is it creates its identities, big identity, rather late in history. And you know, quite late in history. I mean, you have to remember that in the 13th century, Kiev was the Khanate of Kiev, you know, under the grandson of Genghis Khan. So that Eurasian steppes is the one. The Mediterranean was settled early, but the Eurasian steppes is the one that was settled the latest. So creating identities and things that formed late requires a lot of work. A lot of work, and it was helped by Orthodoxy, not because of the religion, but because they had that Slavic language or Church Slavonic as a beacon, as a pure language to work with.
But that curation challenge, which I understand, it's, you know, it's like I understand the challenge of it, but it seems to me the point you're really making is that a state of that size, with that loss of skin in the game, that loss of accountability for the people you're, if you're living in, I'm going to say Leningrad, if you're living in, what is it called now? Is it St. Petersburg?
St. Petersburg.
Okay, thank goodness. Didn't humiliate myself completely. You know, I had COVID recently, Nassim, and they say COVID is tough on your memory.
But I don't know. It increased mine.
Yeah. I didn't have very good memory. I forgot stuff a month ago before I had COVID too. And I get tired in the afternoon before I had COVID. And I still get tired in the afternoon. Oh, yeah, I'm so tired with COVID. But anyway, if you're living in St. Petersburg, it's true. You care about whether the water's clean, whether the bridge has potholes and is safe. You care about the quality of your school if you're going to a public school and so on. And it's true that if Putin has basically named the mayor of St. Petersburg or named the head of the province or whatever, the governor, it's not going to work very well. But isn't that the essential point? That the lack of skin in the game of a large centralized top-down place is the problem, not this curation identity
about. There are a lot of things together, but skin in the game, that's not one of them. It's multifactorial, but I think that it's also easier to manage when it's small. Other than skin in the game, it is communication-wise, because things grow, you know, the connections grow at two, you know, non-linearly when you have a large country. So having this communication network, have all of that, requires more and more effort to just keep the thing centralized. So centralization has not worked in practice aside from skin in the game.
And you're saying the U.S. is partly an exception because it's a more federated system.
It started as a federation, the United States. Yeah. It is, and the individual has a big role in the United States. You don't have a national narrative. You don't have a national language. You can speak Spanish. You can speak Spanish. The common narrative is the law. I mean, that's people talk about the Constitution as if it were religiously. The mechanism, you know, of the United States actually is being used as a model in Europe. You know, to try to have the same thing to hold together these bunch of countries now, the new legal system called EU. And a lot of people are using the United States, we have to also realize, is the oldest, as Switzerland, are the oldest democracies functioning. In at the Congress of Vienna, there were only two democracies, and people didn't understand where's the king. I mean, who does it belong to? Because before, when you had kings, it belonged to a king. So it's a country built differently, and it works.
But I like your metaphor. The thing I've enjoyed so far the most of what we've talked about is it's better to be a mouse than an elephant in many situations, because you're more you're anti-fragile. But of course, there are times you'd rather be an elephant when there's a lot of cats around.
Of course.
The elephant has got those advantages. And
but look at survival. Let's look at numbers. You don't have a lot of elephants left. The mammoth went even before we started messing with the environment, the mammoth disappeared. The large animals disappear quickly. They go extinct very quickly. it tells you something about if you want to survive, be if you're you want your genes to survive or
as a species
to survive. Yes.
But that's one of your big, that's your other big point in some of this writing, which I also love. It's one of the deepest things I've learned from you that as a species, as a group, we really want to avoid ruin. And ruin for one person is a tragedy, of course. A death, a single death is a tragedy, but the death of a people, the death of a species, the death of a humanity on the surface of the earth, that's apocalyptic. That's a cataclysm. That's a catastrophe. It's not a tragedy. And that we should be very aware of things that threaten ruin. We should do that as individuals too. I think it's a powerful personal lesson. But your point is that mice may be vulnerable to a stampeding elephant. But mice as a a mouse might be invulnerable. But mice, they're hanging in there. They're doing pretty well.
Exactly. There's a ton of them. We have more mice in New York than humans, they claim, all right? Can't say the same about elephants in Africa. Even if you scale by, you know, by the size. I have a couple of more things, you know, I'd like to discuss with Modern World. So, and effectively, I just thought of contradicting your idea. So, oh, is it maybe the United States should break up? The rest of the world is trying to resemble the United States.
Is trying to resemble
the United States, the structure. Europe, for example. So it's not, I mean, we're far away from that. Okay. So it works. And it doesn't work in many other places that are large because this structure is effectively, you don't need to belong to another country because you don't feel the need. But you feel the need to belong to another country if you're in Tatarstan, for example, part of the Russian Federation. You want to be out if you're Tatar. You want to be out of Russia if you're Ingush. You want to be out of Russia if you're Chechen. They tried, okay, by the way, before the Ukraine was even more disastrous consequences, more lives lost, per square mile. So one thing I'd like to add is the perception of the system. And that's an idea I'm borrowing from Tocqueville and extending to the modern world. We live in a free world, okay? But sort of like, as you say, not so free because that's the reason. You feel that it's not so free because it's free, you see? It is improving. So Tocqueville realized that the degree of dissatisfaction in a country is proportionate to how good things are, you see. So if you're and effectively, if you know, before we had the internet, people weren't obsessed with freedom of, you know, about people spying on you, but the state had J. Edgar Hoover. You see, now, so the more people talk about loss of liberty and stuff, the more liberty there is in the system. See, at no point in history have we had given more rights to people who are underprivileged. But at no point in history have people complained more. So that comes with a system. Like you see, another phenomenon where transparency can be a problem because you tend to see the bad things more easily in the Western world. Whereas in places like Russia and opaque systems, and you don't see them. See, you see just general, you don't see what's going on, and people don't complain about it. So what happened is states like Russia and China have tried to exploit that attribute of the Western system by creating a distrust of the government on the part of citizens. You see, by, you know, finding examples, the cherry-picking example. It's of course you have malfunction everywhere. It's not perfectly free, but it's free, generally free. See?
I think vigilance is the constant vigilance is the price of liberty, and fighting tyranny is always important. And I just blew that quote because I've had COVID and I can't remember it correctly, but maybe I'll remember by the end of our conversation. But I want to come back to your point in the United States in a different way. I think it would help, I think maybe listeners see this, helps me see it when I think about if the United States had a federal police system. Now we have the FBI, which is a Federal Bureau of Investigation, but suppose all police were employees of the United States. That's a remarkably enormously different system than San Francisco having police, or New York City having police. So all of the terrible things that have happened with police in the last 10 years or so, and of course there may be that before, we weren't as aware of, created enormous backlash. But it's localized, and the people who are accountable have had trouble. If it was at the federal level, it would be hard to hold them accountable.
Yes, exactly. Yes,
it's profoundly important that in a country the scope of the United States, the fact that police is decentralized, even though it's imperfect, doesn't work great, it's not perfect.
Some
accountability, which you would have none of.
Exactly.
The idea of firing the chief of police of the United States because somebody in San Francisco was treated badly or somebody in New York City would be unimaginable, and it would just persist.
So there are two things. Things that are imperfect, okay, but functioning well, self-correcting mechanism. I call the West a self-correcting mechanism, okay, with complaints caused self-correction. So long as complaint leads to something, we had Snowden arguing about ticks. I don't think that he did that in earnest. He wanted to hurt the country, whatever. But it led to some correction. Okay, whatever leads to correction, there's a good system. Now, this is very similar to fooled by randomness. The problem of fooled by randomness. Okay, because you said earlier, the death of a person is statistic. The death of a child is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic, misattributed to Stalin.
I didn't say that. That's what Stalin said. I said death of millions is a catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe. Okay. So all right. So the way we perceive things is again a scale. And I know that from trading. If you show someone his P&L live, he or she would go nuts. They would magnify. If you look at a screen,
what do you mean? P&L being profit and loss.
Yeah, profit and loss. If you're a trader and you see your P&L throughout the day, you go nuts. You see, you have all these emotional swings. Whereas if you see it every day, you have it's better. Okay, and I gave the example in Fooled by Randomness. By saying if something has one unit of standard deviation for one unit of returns, okay, you have, say, 51% chance of being profitable any given day. You see, but you have a very high, 90-some percent chance of being profitable over, a year. So the over longer than a year, like a... something like that. Okay, so the 85% probably being profitable over a year, but very small, and intraday is nothing, 50.01%. So it's the same thing as when you have details. So what disinformation does is provide people with a lot of details rather than essentially to drown you in details, so you don't see the thing at scale. We don't see what we have.
So you're giving a theory of propaganda.
Propaganda.
When I'm surfing on the web, and if my Facebook feed or my Twitter feed is full of these little nagging thorns of dissatisfaction,
yes,
I might start to think I have a bad life when, in fact, I have a great life. It's not perfect.
Exactly. You want to prevent yourself. And the therapy you use as a trader is you look at your life-to-date P&L. You see, so when you focus on your life-to-date P&L, it puts things in perspective. You say, what? This is tiny. Or your year-to-date sometimes when you have a good year. But the best to focus on your life-to-date. This is tiny. And it allows you to continue. But a lot of people don't do that. They're drowning in news. They're drowning. And we're not good at scaling the news. So you have a piece of information. You know how to put it. It's a well-known statistical problem. You have decision scientists and psychologists, who created a whole field with it, the Kahneman-Tversky approach, all that, and how representative that piece of information, how you overestimate its value. So disinformation will play on that, whether it's vaccines or other things. So just to tell you that, hey, we live in a tyranny. Why? Because so-and-so happened, okay? Because you have truckers. And people manage to make you believe that truckers trying to block roads in Canada are equivalent to fighters in Ukraine. You see, So things like that. The mechanism is very linked to fooled by randomness.
Now, it's certainly true that we have trouble putting things in perspective and understanding the law of large numbers in every direction, right? That,
yeah.
That things, it's like when the student complains about the exam being misgraded, and you want to say, are you going to come in when I gave you too many points? You know, when you have lots of exams, it's not a major injustice if your homework is off by a couple points.
Exactly,
10% yeah. of the grade.
It's a question of scaling. It's the same thing as yeah. scaling. How your mind scales, how things scale. You see, the law of large numbers is a question of scaling, how randomness washes out under a large scale. And it's the same problem with a lot of other things related to political life.
So this is really interesting, Nassim, but let's close with this question, and I'll give you a chance to make fun of libertarians, so okay. Which I know you do occasionally, even though you're something
I mean, because
of a libertarian.
I am a deontic libertarian at a, you know, Italian school, and where I think that nobody should coerce me into something, but at the same time, like von Mises, I believe this has limitations.
So you're not an anarchist. We know that. Neither
I'm not an anarchist. I saw anarchy in Lebanon. We see it in Somalia. We see it in Libya. We know what happens when you have no state. Okay. You want to reform the establishment.
So these observations that you've made today and you've started to write about, I think you would describe them generally as, what is the appropriate scale of the state? What is the appropriate scope of the state? And that many of the states today around the world are, quote, too big. So that's an interesting observation. Is it a political message? Is it a rallying cry? Is it just a description and observation of how the world works? Do you want us to all turn into Switzerland? Do you think we should all not move to Switzerland, but do you think all countries should head towards Switzerland in some
or
dimension?
United States or Germany? I mean, people don't realize when I tell them, listen, what's the most successful place in the Near East or place we'd like to go to? They tell you in the Middle East, not Near East. They say Dubai. Dubai is a city-state. Okay. The other one, Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi is a city-state as part of a confederation of city-states. They share an army, okay, and they share an honorific ruler, and they share ambassadors, okay. So you tell them, hey, what's the most successful modern country last 50 years? Singapore. Ah, what is it? A city-state. See, so what? And it's a model for China. I mean, if the Chinese want to survive. Okay, they should read more about the Bronze Age collapse. Bronze Age collapse, uh-huh. And try to build themselves as a confederation of Hong Kong's and Singapore's.
So what is stopping that? What is the? Is it simply the desire
culture.
To
blindness to culture,
and not to accrete? For power to accrete around centers that naturally want to expand?
I think that it all starts with we have bad education in many things. I mean, if you look at French education, how Napoleon was great because he made France great. Are you interested in French or Frenchman? Okay, there's a difference. De Gaulle is actually more not interested in Frenchmen. Interested in glory of France and despised Frenchmen. So just to tell you how bad things can be, the education. They think that it's an entity, a religious entity you have to reify. And all that came after the French Revolution. I mean, all this disease of nation state, you know, came after the French Revolution. And it has some things that are horrible about it. To give you an idea, what happens, the death you have in another country, don't count on your balance sheet. You see, so whereas the Christian religion makes you treat foreigners as equal. So we had a step in the moral field, a step backwards as a nation state. And think about it, they start wars. And I'm going to give you something quite convincing. We looked, Chirillo and I, we study wars. We studied the dynamics and the properties of wars. How many people died in Italy before unification? You had hundreds of wars, like at least, okay, that we know of, okay? Some killed 3 people, all right? Sometimes the same mercenary, and then they settle, okay? Small towns, small wars between papal states and this. And some killed, of course, 15,000. But over 500 years, okay, the number is somewhere between, we think, 15,000 under 80,000 people died in wars. The first war cost Italy 680,000 soldiers.
First World War.
First World War. 680,000 people. Okay. So you realize what nation states, they like war.
But isn't part of that, aren't you confounding the advances in technology that made the First World War much more lethal? Mm-hmm. Wasn't merely that it was the wage between nation states, right?
Maybe, but have you seen states waging wars? We had the defensive states waging wars with the Greek Confederation against the state, you know, the Persian state. But the when you think about what I mean, city states have waged wars, but nothing central. That's not part of the record. That's not the business they're in.
Well, the other point that to make your point, when they wage a war, its impact is limited. It's your point about, you know, a couple of people drink and drive. Well, some of them are going to die. They're going to be taken out of the gene pool, and they're not going to kill other people down the road, literally. And city states that get rambunctious, they may cause some trouble in the neighborhood, but they're not going to.
Exactly. It doesn't generalize quickly. It doesn't generalize quickly. I mean, so I'm not wrong to say that they're never bellicose. We have had, you know, in Italy, it's always over something small, and it's never systemic. Like Hitler wanted, you know, something systemic, wanted, you know, the German race to dominate this part of territory, this swath of territory, or what we have with the Russians.
So I really like this vision, but, you know, it reminds me a little bit of my favorite poem by Hilaire Belloc, although I have a couple. It's called Passivism. It goes like this. It's very short. Pale Ebenezer thought it wrong to fight, but Roaring Bill, who killed him, thought it right. So if you're – it's nice – end of poem. So it's nice to have a city state that minds its own business, involves – engages in commerce, let people flourish, choose their own – paths in life and so on. But in a world of nations, a city state's very vulnerable, and there's a natural tendency towards forming a nation. So any imaginable path toward a reduction in the
exactly.
centralization.
Yeah, I told you NATO. NATO is there. That's the purpose of NATO. That's why I was excited about NATO. You see? Okay. That's how it started. That's how this whole essay on Ukraine started in Ukraine, rather than Ukraine before the war, because it was like Hannibal at Portas, you know, Hannibal at the gates. You know, they all saw this monster, okay, silent monster, you know.
Elephant, but a bear.
exactly. So it was a bear, not an elephant. So they saw, you know, at the border trying to get in, and sure enough, trying to explain the notion of a system where these things don't happen. Small states. I mean, it was said nationalism works at small scale because, you know, it's, you know, you may not like your neighbors, but you end up dealing with them. And look what's happening in Yugoslavia. Has people. Forget to look at Yugoslavia as the best experience we had in years. And there's actually an additional state to the six. Kosovo is a state now, part of former Yugoslavia. When you think about it, this works.
I guess you would also make the observation that NATO's military power under the umbrella of a set of nation states, all smaller than the whole, has yet to run amok. Is that an accurate statement? There's never been an aggressive war of aggression by that kind of confederation. It's a defensive confederation. Is that? Am I romancing it?
No. You're not romancing it. The only problem was NATO. I mean, I'm going to play the devil's advocate. A lot of people say NATO is an extension of the United States, using their colonies, you know, militarily speaking, to do work for them, okay?
Union is an extension of Germany, using their colonies. Yeah,
exactly. You hear the same thing. We're going to hear a lot of things. But you know, to end, my point is that I've spoken to a lot of political scientists over time, and not one of them was interested in scaling. So you just introduced the notion of scaling, nonlinearity of scaling, to the discussions, and you come up with all these results, you know, that are obvious and answers a lot of questions that are obvious. Scaling is important. They didn't think about it. Communism failed in Soviet Union. Is it because communism is bad? Or is it a question of scale? Communism works in a kibbutz, no? You had a kibbutz fellow. It all sort of worked in a kibbutz, no?
Yeah, or in the family, as we talked about many times.
Exactly. It works in a kibbutz, but not the failed Soviet Union. So we ignore that the essential thing that people who work with nonlinearity and nonlinear responses under uncertainty are familiar with. So we just translate some of our modest knowledge about nonlinear response to questions of foreign affairs, political science, and international relations.
My guest today has been Asim Nicholas Taleb. Asim, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you. I'm always honored to be here.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.